Hello, my name is Mike Rogan. This is the interview of Catherine Collins McCoy, Kathy, on behalf of the SEC Historical Society Topics for Oral History. Today is May the 11th, 2005, and we're conducting this interview in Kathy McCoy's house in Oxford, Maryland. It is approximately a quarter to one on Wednesday afternoon, on May the 11th. Kathy, let's start by talking about your educational background and how you came to work at the SEC.
Hi, Mike. Thank you. I started work at the SEC in May 1975. As I completed my first year of law school at American University, I came to work as a law clerk in the chief counsel's office in the Division of Corporation Finance and had that position for the next 2 years while I completed my legal education. And I think it would be safe to say that I started my SEC career on the strong recommendation of my predecessor, the person who was the law clerk in the chief counsel's office prior to me, was a dear personal friend and one whom I had a great deal of regard for, whose name was Doug Woodlock. And Doug encouraged me when I indicated that I was going to need to, for economic reasons, transfer to the Knight Division and of the law school and seek a law clerk job. He encouraged me that this was the best law clerk job in Washington and that I should take that. And my confidence in Doug, I should say as an aside, has been, I think, was well placed. Doug is now a federal district court judge in the First District. Serving with distinction. So he's a very important SEC alum. And that's how I came to Corp Fin.
So you were a law clerk in the chief counsel's office while in law school and then were hired permanently once you graduated?
That's correct. I was hired permanently and in fact was the envy of my law school classmates because I never went through the rigors of interviewing because I was offered a permanent job as a branch attorney and at that time I couldn't think of any job I'd rather have than being able to stay on in Corp Fin. So I took a position as a branch attorney and branch 8, as I recall. My branch chief was Howard Morin and I had that position reviewing registration statements and proxy statements and 34 Act reports for a couple of years, and then had the opportunity to go to the general counsel's office. And I did that, worked in the general counsel's office in a new unit that the then general counsel, Ralph Ferrara, was establishing called the Counseling Group. And I was recruited to be a member of the counseling group team. It turns out that I didn't enjoy that quite as much as my Corp Fin work. So after about a year in the counseling group, I returned to Corp Fin. The counseling group's main function was to review the commission calendar, review memoranda from Enforcement Division as well as the operating of the Corp Fin and Investment Management Divisions with their rulemaking recommendations and other matters that required commission action, to review those and separately advise the commission as to whether the division making the recommendation was making the right recommendation or doing so for the right reason.
Who was the chairman at that time?
I think it was Harold Williams. This would have been 1978, 79. I also remember during this time, Roberta Carmel was a commissioner, and John Evans was a commissioner, whom you know well, Mike, as one of his law clerks.
And I remember now that you mentioned the counseling group, because I think there was some sense at the commission level that the staff of some of the divisions had perhaps too independent a view, and this was a way to make sure that the law didn't get too creative.
I think so. I think there was also a view at the staff level in the divisions. The counseling group was not the most welcome development from the perspective of the staff, because now, in addition to having to satisfy the chairman and the other four commissioners and their respective legal assistants about the soundness of your legal analysis, the precision of your rule drafting, etc., you now had to also satisfy another whole group, which was the general counsel's office counseling team. And sometimes there would be warring memos. One of my friends at the time, as I recall, being the late 70s, there had been a crisis of confidence in New York City about its police department and some corruption scandals, and whoever was mayor of New York had put in a civilian review board to oversee the police department and make sure it wasn't out of hand and restore public confidence in the New York City police. And one of my friends, who was still in Court Finn, referred to me and the rest of the counseling group team as the civilian review board, which captured, I think, pretty well, at least at the staff level in the divisions, how welcome this added scrutiny was.
I'd forgotten that. So you came back to Court Finn.
I went back to Court Finn. A position opened. When I was a law clerk in the chief counsel's office, I was actually very lucky because I had the opportunity, even before graduating from law school, to be involved in drafting some rules, doing rulemaking, drafting releases, and had enjoyed that very much. So a position opened up in Court Finn in the Office of Disclosure Policy, and I decided to apply for that because, frankly, after a year in the counseling group, I decided it would be more interesting to be doing the original work myself, doing the rulemaking and writing the releases, than just second-guessing those who had done them. And so I was lucky enough to get that position, and so I moved back to Court Finn and to Disclosure Policy, and then did primarily rulemaking for quite a few years.
And who was the division director then, and who was the head of the Disclosure Policy Office?
The division director when I started was Alan Levinson, and then after he left, Dick Rowe was the division director. When I moved back to Court Finn, I believe Ed Green was then director, and Lee Spencer was the associate director or deputy director who had responsibility for disclosure policy, and John Huber had just become the head of the Office of Disclosure Policy when I joined it. So I worked very closely with John Huber then for a number of years, which was really a great privilege. He's a terrific lawyer and mentor, and made the rulemaking process really intellectually challenging and interesting and fun.
And what rules do you remember working on under?
Well, we worked on the huge project of the integrated disclosure system, which carried on work that had started in prior years under Dick Rowe's leadership. Dick had started Regulation SK, and there existed Form S-16, which was the short form that incorporated 34 reports for 33 at purposes, but only for resales of restricted securities rather than fresh capital raising. And under the leadership of Ed Green and Lee Spencer and John Huber, and Mike Connell, who was briefly at the commission as an associate director for some part of that project, we put a whole team together in the Office of Disclosure Policy and proposed extensive organization of Regulation SK to put all of the substantive disclosure requirements there rather than repeating them in the various 33 Act or 34 Act forms, repeating but never quite the same and creating confusion. And forms S1, 2, and 3. One of the most heated parts that I remember and that was directly my responsibility was the shelf registration group. And I say heated because it was an interesting study in rulemaking history. The rule was proposed, and since it was in the nature to allow shelf registration for new capital raising, was fairly revolutionary, but relying on the efficient market theory and restricting it to seasoned companies with 34 Act reports that were widely followed, made sense intellectually and was certainly welcomed by the issuer community. And since it was in the nature of deregulation, everyone seemed, the commentators that is, that those affected by the commission's rules, just almost automatically or by reflex applauded it in the comment process. But then late in the process, just before adoption of the rule would have been on the schedule, all of a sudden the Wall Street community seems to wake up and realize this might not be good for us. This could affect us in ways that we don't like. And deluged the commission with visits, with adverse comment letters, and a huge hue and cry.
What didn't they like about it?
Well, there was the text and the subtext, or the spoken and the unspoken. I think they were concerned that this would really jeopardize investor protection, that a prospectus without full disclosure physically present in it would be harmful to new investors, and that the commission was really just not living up to its mandate to protect investors. The fact that most prospectuses at that point in time were never seen by the investors until they got them with the confirmation after they had made the investment decision undercut that argument, but that was an argument made nonetheless. The staff and the commission actually thought that part of the problem was that it was a fear of upsetting the traditional underwriter relationship with issuer, which could cause issuers to essentially shop around for underwriters and lead to adverse impact on the underwriter's fees. Now, to the extent that might happen, that was something that the staff and the commission thought would be a good thing, because
Competition
is not a bad thing. Their argument was that the quality of disclosure would suffer because underwriters would come in at the last minute, and issuers would be reluctant to change the disclosure in a previously issued 34 Act report for fear that changing it might suggest an admission that it wasn't accurate before. But when the underwriters come in to do a public offering, historically and up to that point, the underwriters going through with their counsel, going through the issuer's the perspectives draft, line by line, challenging every bit of content, was what improved the quality of disclosure and protected investors. To a certain extent, their arguments convinced the staff that we were right, that if most of the market activity going on was secondary market activity in reliance on 34-act reports, that a system that put the 34-act reports in a very much secondary role in terms of quality, and where issuers and underwriters and counsel only really focused on disclosure when there was a 33-act registration statement, was not a good system. It didn't help most investors and didn't help support the quality of disclosure in the market that was really needed, and that attention should be shifted to the 34-act report. But this was not done without a fight. So hearings were held, which was my first experience running hearings on a proposed rulemaking, and that was pretty interesting.
And who was on the commission at that time? And in sort of today's era, we have a fairly divided commission. Was the commission divided on this?
It was, as a matter of fact. Barbara Thomas was on the commission, and Jim Treadway.
John Evans.
John Evans was
still on.
Was still there. That's what I was thinking. And I'm having a hard time remembering who was chairman at that point. This was 82.
And so who was the commission at that time?
The chairman was John Shadd. And Barbara Thomas, Jim Treadway, John Evans were commissioners at that time.
And it was a divided vote, or do you remember?
I remember that Barbara Thomas was opposed to the shelf rule, may even have written a dissent. I believe she did write a dissent. Jim Treadway ended up voting in favor, as did the chairman. And so it was probably a 3-2 vote with two dissents.
And then after the shelf registration rule is one that's worked great now, and everyone
it
did everything that it needed to do.
Yeah, I think it did. It was a real success. That's something that I was really very privileged to be part of a rulemaking proceeding that did have such a dramatic impact and focused, it did what it was supposed to do, in that it focused greater attention on 34-act reports and less on the, including this, not just the preparation of 34-act reports, the greater attention being focused by issuers, but also the staff's attention focused on 34-act reports.
And what other rulemaking initiatives do you remember from that era? Didn't you work on the beneficial ownership rules?
I did. That was a little bit later. By then, I was I got involved directly as the point person when I was associate director of legal in the division, which was a few years later. There had been a corporate governance staff report headed up by Amy Goodman, and among the controversial recommendations coming out of that was one that was very important to the issuer community. They were seeking to find out, to be able to contact the beneficial owners of street name securities, because at that point, issuers were having a hard time, in some cases at annual meetings, even being able to muster a quorum to elect directors and ratify auditors. Just basic corporate actions were becoming stymied because so much of the stock ownership was in street names, through brokers held in street names. brokers were obviously highly concerned for competitive reasons about disclosing who their clients were, who their customers were. The commission, headed up by Amy, and then I took over this task, put together a committee with representatives from the New York Stock Exchange as the referees, and the issuer side as well as the broker-dealer side, getting together and forming a committee that I served on as the SEC observer or representative, to try to come up with an approach which ended up being the NOBO, the non-objecting beneficial ownership rules, to put together an approach that did not violate, didn't upset the broker-dealer community from a competition standpoint, didn't violate customer privacy rights or concerns or expectations, but still allowed the issuers to get in touch with their non-objecting beneficial owners. The non-objecting, one of the big sticking points, as I recall, was whether affirmative consent of the customer was necessary or whether it was sufficient to that they simply didn't object to receiving material directly. And then an intermediary was established so that the issuer didn't get the addresses. The intermediary got the addresses with the broker information stripped, and it was all very elaborate, but actually kind of fun to watch. Amazing, in fact, to see that that these two sides who have been so far apart could actually get together on something that would be helpful.
It's funny when you think back on like all of the energy on did you have to affirmatively consent versus just be not object to the disclosure, all of the energy that can go into a decision like that, that, you know, when you're 5 years past the time or 10 years past the time, you really sometimes sit back and say, did we really spend all that time coming to this conclusion? And were you in disclosure policy or Corp Fin when executive comp became such a big issue in the 80s and 90s and remains with us today?
I was. I'm not sure if I should admit that. I had some responsibility for some of the interpretive releases. Not the totality of the disclosure. But as a matter of fact, I did work on a rework of that item in an effort to try to streamline the interpretive problems that it created. I'm not sure how successful that effort was, because I think it's just inherently one of those areas that is one of those disclosure concepts that compliance is never going to be all that happy.
And did you work on the Q&A releases?
Mm-hmm. I did.
And what is a perquisite?
I did. It's interesting how the integrated disclosure and shelf rule releases were just much more intellectually satisfying to me, and therefore came to mind more promptly than executive compensation and what constituted a perk. Had to be done, but it wouldn't necessarily be a highlight.
Well, what other things do you remember as being highlights of your disclosure time? So, the non-objecting beneficial ownership rules, what other executive comp, what other big rulemakings were you part of in your time in the 90s?
80s. Yeah. Actually, the other, what became a huge rulemaking project that we undertook after completing the integrated disclosure project, that having been a multi-year effort, including the shelf rule, we looked around, since disclosure policy was purely a rulemaking office, we just looked around and decided that an area that was ripe for review and hopefully we hoped for streamlining and simplification was Section 16 and all of the rules and interpretations thereof had grown out of control. Just too difficult an area for insiders to try to comply with in good faith. It was really a tough area. So that was a project that began while I was in disclosure policy, and I was part of the decision to undertake that project. I must say that it was such a huge project to undertake that it then went on for years before ever seeing the light of day in the form of proposals. I then moved up to become associate director legal, and the other big rulemaking initiatives going on at that time involved EDGAR. So Amy Goodman, a separate associate director position was created for EDGAR implementation, and Amy Goodman headed that up. While I was in charge of the non-EDGAR rulemaking through disclosure policy, as well as the chief counsel's office, which involved no action letters and interpretations, as well as enforcement liaison. The Section 16 project consumed a lot of staff time, but didn't result in a proposal actually going forward during my stay at the commission. I spent then, while I was associate director, a lot of my time involved enforcement liaison, because a lot of enforcement cases during that era were cooked books cases, accounting fraud. So that a CorpFin, it either would have been a case that started in CorpFin with a CorpFin referral, or that enforcement pursued from other sources, but in any event, CorpFin and the chief accountant in CorpFin, Howard Hodges, and I would be involved to make sure that accounting policy was consistent across the board, that CorpFin's view of the appropriate accounting was consistent with the enforcement division's view of the appropriate accounting, so that the agency was speaking with one voice or on one sheet of paper about how what the appropriate standards for revenue recognition, one of the favorite hot button cookbooks cases, would be. At that point, when I was associate director, the chief counsel was Bill Morley, who was obviously incredibly capable and a joy to work with, both on a personal and professional level. Bill handled his duties as chief counsel so well that it freed me up to spend a lot of time, the time that was needed, to try to have Howard Hodges try to educate a non-accountant on the relevant accounting rules in each case, and then so that we could then make sure that we in enforcement were sending the same message.
Who was division director of enforcement at that time?
Gary Lynch was director during a lot of that time that I'm speaking of.
And do you remember any big cases that the commission brought as a result of your, or at least with your participation?
Of any particular case names right now.
And was, you were talking about Howard Hodges and the chief accountant's office for CorpFin. Did you have much intersection with the chief accountant's office for the commission?
I did actually have a great deal. We called it the big chief accountant's office, so that we in CorpFin would refer to it that way, so that we didn't get confused between Howard Hodges and Clarence Sampson's offices. The big chief accountant's office typically did not get involved in enforcement cases. That would be CorpFin's chief accountant liaising on that. But I got involved with the big chief accountant's office very extensively in rulemaking. There were a lot of accounting issues associated with the various projects in the big integrated disclosure project. For instance, the 10Q revisions. We overhauled 10Q, and that release, believe it or not, this was kind of a novel thing, was co-authored by one of the professional accounting fellows in the big chief accountant's office and me. Which, having a lawyer and an accountant try to draft a single document was an interesting exercise for both of us in compromise and collegiality. But it was fun. It was, the 10Q is an important report, and the accounting side for the unaudited financial requirements is at least half of the document, half of the report, so it had to be something that was jointly done. But really, the rulemaking, I was often involved with the big chief accountant's office because of the years I spent doing rulemaking.
And if you, so at this point we're in the late 80s, you're associate director, responsibility for chief counsel's office, liaison between CorpFin and enforcement. What came next?
An opportunity came up. Jim Treadway, who had been a commissioner, had left and gone into private practice. And as I mentioned, this is an era when there were an awful lot of accounting frauds. Today we look. Today they might not seem as bad, since we've now lived through Enron and WorldCom and others in the last few years of the more recent times. But at the time in 1986, it seemed as if there had been a lot of accounting failures. And Jim was asked by the accounting professional groups to head up a private sector blue ribbon panel, which was called the National Commission on Fraudulent Financial Reporting, but really always referred to as the Treadway Commission. And it was sponsored by the AICPA, the Financial Executives Institute, the American Accounting Association, which is the academic accounting group. And so Jim was charged with this, setting up this commission to study the phenomenon and come up with recommendations to help issuers, regulators, Congress, whoever, the whole group of people who were affected by or had responsibility for financial reporting and protecting investors, to try to come up with recommendations how, if at all, this could be prevented or reduced in the future. So I was given the opportunity to go join that effort and served as the general counsel to the Treadway Commission. So that was when my SEC career ended. Although I was still, it was almost like a halfway house or a gradual transition to the private sector, because it was still for the next year and a half when I worked on the Treadway Commission report doing public interest work and with the interest of investor protection, the same as I had been during my 11 years at the SEC.
And the Treadway Commission report is still, in the Sarbanes-Oxley world we operate in today, is still a basic underpinning of large pieces of Sarbanes-Oxley, 404, internal controls. A lot of that grows out of the work of the Treadway Commission. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about how that report got developed. What was the process by which you did your work?
It was a multi-pronged approach. The commissioners, and it was a very impressive group of commissioners, I might add. Besides Jim Treadway, Mill Batten, who had been CEO of JCPenney and then chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, who's then retired, was one commissioner. Bill Kanaga, who had just retired as chairman of Arthur Young, which was then one of the major accounting firms. Tom Storrs, who had just retired as chairman of the board of what was then NCNB, is now Bank of America. Another commissioner was Hugh Marsh, who was just retired from the position of chief internal auditor of Alcoa Corporation. And Don Troutline had just retired as chairman of the board and CEO of Bethlehem Steel. So the assembled group included, therefore, the perspective of regulator in the form of New York Stock Exchange and SEC, the perspective of several different types of corporations, as well as outside auditor and inside auditor. So impressive group who really took their work seriously. They chartered a number of studies that were done, some internally by the Treadway Commission staff, some done in the academic world at the request of the Commission staff, and then they also conducted expert interviews to essentially seek the views of the best and the brightest on this phenomenon and what could be done to shore things up. The overriding emphasis in the report was, the conclusion was fairly almost simple in that the group's conclusion was that everybody involved in the process, there are lots of people involved in the process that ends up with a public company's financial reporting. And everybody involved can do their job, job better. And that what can cause that to happen is an improved tone at the top. The internal auditor was seen internal control systems were seen as insufficiently used resource in that process. And a lot of emphasis in the report went to that internal control systems should not be an afterthought, should not be under the responsibility of the same people who produce the financial reporting. There should be a separate line of chain of command or reporting line directly to the board, to the audit committee, to the CEO, but don't have the fox guarding the chicken coop. There are some very simple things that look simple, but in fact can make a difference. That was kind of the overall theme there. Some of the report's recommendations were acted upon immediately, those that were directed to the Auditing Standards Board to shore up the actual rules under which outside auditors do their work, were adopted immediately. But others were never implemented, those that required legislation or tough action that is expensive, like requiring every public company to have an internal control system and an internal auditor, is expensive. So the report, obviously done by a private sector group, had no teeth in and of itself, so it simply sought to persuade those to whom it was addressed.
So how does it feel to have been the general counsel for that commission and see now in 2002 with Sarbanes-Oxley being adopted, to see those recommendations really come into their own in a sense and actually be implemented by Congress?
It's satisfying. It's also a little troubling because I think that implementing things like the Treadway Commission recommendations by legislation is not necessarily the best way to implement them. Because I think what's happened is that the expense side of the equation is out of whack, and there needs to be some tinkering, and it's tougher to tinker with legislation than it is with regulation. you can fine-tune rules a lot more easily than you can go back in and change legislation. There was the moment that legislation passed because the accounting fraud so shocked the national conscience that there was a moment when it could happen, and that's when it happened.
The Treadway Commission report issued?
The report was issued in 1987. And actually, I should correct, I was general counsel and deputy executive director of that exercise, which was really a lot of fun. It was a very, very nice project. After that, I since the commission sunsetted itself, went out of business, I then began my private practice career by moving to Arnold and Porter and practiced there for the rest of my career.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.